One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, where the podcast that gets people talking like there's no microphone in front of them, using the power of music and the way it binds to memories in an almost mystical way. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest today is Luke Century. He's a self-taught artist who lives out on Sanibel Island. But first, he was born in Newark, New Jersey, and studied business at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He says his primary interest as a young student was art, specifically photography. He got into etching while working at a resort, engraving people's names on snow skis. Then a window washing job in the 1970s led to a four-year exploration of how to transfer images and color onto glass, which resulted in a process for creating stencils that could be used in sandblast engraving, which he has applied extensively and prolifically over the years. You might be best known for being the person who engraved the more than 58,000 names into the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. Luke's bio says his considerable spiritual energy and heartfelt intent is always at play, and that his love of nature, the aesthetic beauty that lies within, is permanently embedded in his work. And as someone who has seen lots of his work over the years, I'd say that's quite true and evident. He's lived on Sanibel now for 30 years with his illustrator wife, Dee, cranking out the art and living the island life. Well, I've met Luke a few times over the years. We've never really had a chance to talk and get to know each other at all, but that's why we're here today. So let's go.
Hey there, Luke. Nice to see you again.
Oh, great to see you, Mike. Yeah.
Business. You studied business in college? I got to start there. In uncovering your background, that's what stopped me in my tracks. Whose idea was that?
I think it was process of elimination. I was taking intro psychology or whatever I could, you know, do intro-wise to try to stimulate an interest academically. And it just didn't really connect. And then business just seemed to be the last resort.
Well, what about art? If you were into art before you got to college, was that even a consideration at the time, or was that just not something that one did?
Well, I went to like a pre-professional school at Case Western Reserve, and everybody around me was trying to do something that, you know, they'd come out with a degree and then apply it that way professionally. And so photography is how I was accessing the art as a young man, you know, in junior high school. But it never really connected in college. I took maybe one art course. So I was always self-taught, and it was fine. It was more like a hobby.
How did you get started in photography?
Oh, well, actually, it was ninth grade, and a neighbor just offered knew that I was interested in photography because I had a camera. And he said, you know, I just don't utilize my darkroom anymore. Would you like to have it? I was floored. Hmm. I mean, it was an offer that I've never had someone really just give me.
Especially
something
at that age. I mean, as a ninth grader, that's...
It was really something. And I was so excited. And my parents happened to have a third floor without it being utilized. And so I went upstairs to that bathroom and just threw the darkroom together. And it's like I went up and at night and just never came down. I was just entranced with it.
What kind of camera were you using?
It was always seemed to be a Canon.
Okay.
You know, my goodness, you know, it started probably with a single reflex.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you ever do any medium format stuff or any of the larger print sizes or larger, you know, negatives?
I think I got up to a 2.25.
Okay.
But I ended up with a 4x5 and larger.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was I developed another technique that maybe we can get into later on.
I definitely want to get into the other techniques.
All right. Yeah, they're
I'm
different.
A self-taught experimental artist myself, so I want to pick your brain.
Yeah, alternative photographic techniques seemed to be, you know, the direction I was headed into, and with the engraving as well, which is what I ended up doing.
Do you still take pictures today? Do you have a digital camera? When was the last time you were in a dark room? Do you still shoot film ever?
I use a dark room for a totally different process. It's photographic, but it's done without a camera or a lens. And basically, I mean, that's these days, the last 30 years. So I developed a technique where you just are using photo paper and raw light, and hopefully you're going to get the extraneous energy around you, let's say. And it does, in my mind, materialize bizarrely to most people. How do you see that actually being possible? But that's how experimental I am. I'm trying to see what we radiate as people. And it seems to me as though the photo medium is a receptor to that.
One of the things, we're totally off the rails here. So that's okay. That's fine. That's what I love about this show. We can go anywhere we want. It's our show. I've always tried to consciously find ways to instill or capture randomness in my photography somehow. And that mm-hmm. seems like kind of what you're after.
Well, random, you know, it is.
Or just something that takes my, you know, I don't want total control. I want there to be something else that has some shared control with me. I'm with you on that. Okay.
So totally. And so I'm very open and it just seems as though the mind is very extensive, okay? And this is all experiential. It's not a religious thing or anything where I came to. Only on my own through experimenting through art did I realize that, you know, that looks very familiar. And I just don't believe that many people have really looked through the gray matter, let's say. If you're in a dark room and you know, you have a mistake. Instead of, you know, like say all of a sudden the light came on. If sometimes, like, it's as simple as pouring cream in your coffee and it becoming a pattern. But somehow I believe that we are vibratory creatures and the mind can be at play here. And so I'm an experimenter. And I've come up with some amazing results, in my opinion.
Cool. Well, let's get back on the Three Song Stories train. What was the musical background of your childhood? You grew up north. What was happening to you around you musically through your parents and just your world?
I lived in New Jersey, in Clifton, New Jersey, until I was 8. And my only memories are of music back then are when my mom would take me to the city, to New York City, and we'd go to hear like Leonard Bernstein's children's music sessions, you know, with the Philharmonic.
Okay.
And I just remember being up close and Leonard being very, very conductive in his playful way, and was impacted that way, as well as I remember being taken to some Pete Seeger concerts.
Oh.
And I think and those were very impactful as well. So I think I went twice. You know, record-wise, I just remember musicals.
Okay. That's what your folks were playing or that's
what? That's what they were playing. And there was a piano in the house. And I think I was, you know, taking some piano lessons.
So you did play a little bit of piano?
A little bit. But classical music is all I was kind of being taught at the time.
So there's no radio playing the popular music of the time?
I don't remember listening to the radio back then. It's just, I don't know. I think I was just running around playing ball. Mostly.
Do you remember what the first music that you owned was as a kid or as a young adult?
Probably the Beatles.
Yeah?
I think it was maybe in sixth grade when that came to the States and it was just happening. And
you're right.
I don't ever remember buying the album, but I did buy a Beatles lunchbox, and then I had my mom make sandwiches for, and then I even remember the Beatles haircut that everybody tried to emulate.
Can you remember what your folks thought of the Beatles? Did they have an impression or an opinion?
No, I
one
think
way
you
or
know,
another?
My folks just whatever struck my curiosity, they supported. And so I don't remember exactly how they felt about it. I think my sister and I were the crazy ones, you know, about the music.
Right.
And they would be playing classical music on the piano throughout the house. And that's my memory of their involvement in music was opera and classical music.
Can you remember the first time music moved you somehow? As somebody who seems like your mind is open to emotion and spirituality and the way things all tie together. Can you remember a musical moment that tapped into something?
Not really. I just ended up dancing a lot.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So I became a dancer. I mean, I remember being moved all from the beginning. And even it was classical. I mean, to the point where it's just like if I went to say – I ended up being in Cleveland after eight years of age. And I remember going to Severance Hall a lot to the concerts. And I remember, you know, there wasn't much movement going on in the audience, but my head started to rock. And I was just like moving to the classics. And no one else around me would, but I just let it go. And
still a dancer today?
I am.
I read in on your website that you met your wife on the dance floor?
We did. We did up at the Crow's Nest on Captiva at Tween Waters Inn. And it was in 1983. And we literally bumped into each other. No one was on that dance floor, but I think I was headed to Cannes and came back. And then she crossed over and somehow we knocked into each other and I asked her to dance. It was just going to happen that way.
How did you wind up on Sanibel in 1983?
Well, I was actually taking a reprieve from Engraving Names on the Wall.
Okay.
On the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in D.C.
So that was in the midst of that happening?
Yes. And it was because I was adding names after it was dedicated and installed. And so I just needed to get to a beach. So I ended up in Miami and I was going to head out to the Keys. And I ended up going to the Jets-Dolphins game the day I flew in because my cousin took me. I had rented a car with everything in it. And when we came back from the game, my car was stolen. My rental car was
okay.
Stolen. So I was thwarted. And somehow I met a guy at a party who said, hey, you know, if I was looking for a beach, I'd go to this place called Sanibel. And I said, I have no clue where this is. He said, do you have a map? I took out that map and put it on the hood of my new rental car. And lo and behold, he pointed it out. And I said, I'm headed over there. And so I just happened to make it to Sanibel on the fact that I was thwarted.
So and then you met your wife and then you moved there and then you still are here today and all because of serendipity.
Oh, so much synchronicity and serendipity going on. So yeah, absolutely. I live my life that way and it used to be rare when it would happen, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's like if it doesn't happen every day, it's I feel like I'm off.
Oh, thumbs up to that. Yeah. Let's move to your first song.
Great.
What is your first song?
The first song is Four Dead in Ohio. Ohio.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the story behind it or do you want to let's listen to it and then we can come out of it and you can be fresh in the moment?
Yeah, let's listen to it first.
Okay.
That'd be great.
All right. This is Four Dead in Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young from their 1971 album Four Way Street. You're listening to Three Song Stories. It's biography through music.
Soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own.
So where and when does that take you?
Well, I believe it's 1968, Kent State. I was in Cleveland at the time, and we were young activists, and there was just a lot of work that even a youngster of at my age was feeling that we needed to do to try to sever our involvement with Vietnam. There was a lot of protesting going on the streets, and a lot of opportunity to raise your hand and say I have a voice, and half of the community was really, you know, against the war, and the other half was for the administration's policies, and we were just speaking our minds. And I was a member of the Student Mobilization Committee, and we were trying to express that, resisting the draft was okay. And it was, a draft. It's different than it is today, where it's a volunteer army. So if your number came up, you were going. And I knew soon enough that I was going to be of age myself.
Right.
So, you know, you were working for the process to work, you know, for you as well as for others.
Do you remember the first time you heard that song? Do you remember, because it's got, you know, that song's got a lot of cultural energy in it.
Yeah. I think I remember listening to it a lot. The first time, I don't know if my mind's really wired that way.
Well, yeah, no, yeah, I don't really mean it when I say that.
I was working at a camp up in New Hampshire. It was called World Fellowship Camp. And I remember underneath the sign, it said, "All races, creeds, and kinds were welcome here." And we had some of the Kent State people who were running at the time from the law. Make it up that way. And so I think that's partly how I was intertwined with it, was that there were people on not knowing where to go because they were being hustled after.
So let's bridge that then to 15 or so years later. How did you wind up on the Vietnam Memorial Project? And what must have that been like for you emotionally and psychologically to be on suddenly on the, you know what I mean?
On another spectrum with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, down you're on, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I was getting into healing at the time. You know, I thought, well, maybe I could do massage therapy or whatever. You know, I just felt like a calling there. And so I was more into, you know, having everybody just feeling better about who they were. And so at the moment, you know, the whole death aspect of building a memorial, I felt totally different than how I did with initially, you know, as a youngster during the war. This was part of recognizing people who were fighting for a cause and who were caught up in something, and felt great honor in being involved in the calling to go to war, and I was okay with that because I know I was calling against it, but this is the result. This is something that maybe we can learn from. And as powerful as the memorial as Maya Lin created, I'm certain that that's how it has ended up, is that we are all, it's registered, you know, on a very deep level for us as a nation. And we need to evolve, hopefully, as to what war is and when it's well-suited.
You know, a friend of mine's daughter is, I don't know if you've seen through media reports, or you may even know, or Stacey Brown's daughter, Sarah, is the one who's done the collateral damage installations, she calls it, where she writes down the names of the victims of mass shootings. And I interviewed her and we talked about what that's like. She's done it like four times now, to like be in the presence of those names, you know, over and over again. What was that like for you? I mean, was it just, did you have to detach and sort of just be mm-hmm. mechanical about it? Or, mm-hmm. you know, how did that work?
Well, I did two aspects for the memorial. I called Maya Lin and told her I thought I had a technique to do the initial 58,000 names. And she had just been, you know, taken aback by how she was being received. And she was a little curt with me on the phone. I just happened to call her in Athens and I got her mom. And then I was there calling the project director in no time flat. And so I developed a technique for the original 58,000. And so I was dealing with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. And so getting that done was not done with the public.
Right.
But then they, after dedication day, they asked me to come up with a technique to add the names. So all of a sudden I found myself at the wall adding names with the public coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to focus on doing a job that was very critical and you couldn't screw up.
Right.
I was very, very focused but people were coming up to me and asking me questions a lot. And I didn't really have much of a guard there. And so it was very, very difficult. People were coming to the wall for the first time, trying to find their loved ones and whatnot. And then I had a job to do, but I needed to be sensitive. So yeah, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
How long did it take you overall?
Well, adding the names was the biggest challenge for me because you have to prefabricate a stencil and then go on site and deal with the environment.
Right.
Okay. So I was adding names for 3 years and I added wow. actually exactly 100 names, which equals my last name. Just happened to be that way. But originally, we did the original 58,000 in about 3 or 4 months. So we got it done in time. We saved them about $7 million and a process that was not known in the industry. So we probably saved them 3 years too.
Real quickly, what is the process? And I've seen you do the sandblast thing. Mm-hmm. Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Was it granite was being carved in a old-fashioned way and then you said, hey, I can do it using mm-hmm. this basically?
Yes.
Is that kind of it in a nutshell?
Yes, it is because it was done with a cookie cutter method before where it was a stamp and you would with a stamp cut out the perimeter of the lettering with a sharp blade and you would have had to like put all these letters in a slot and then just stamp out this name and then align it by hand. And so when I called and said I could do this photographically and very efficiently, the project director fell out of his chair and I sent them samples right away. And I was written, my process was just absorbed immediately. So what was your question?
No, yeah, you explained it. Yeah, I've always just wondered, you know, because I know I heard through stories that, you know, they said it was going to take, you know, 30 years and you said I could do it in 3 months.
Well, yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, so it's a photo stenciled sandblasting mask. So basically we thankfully had the capability of typesetting names and putting them on the film, which was the artworks, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
And then these large panels were laid flat and then coated with this photo emulsion that I created, and which was going to become the resist.
Right, right.
For sandblasting. But
right.
you just through contact and exposure and then washing out with high pressure water, you were left with a flexible mask that was the resist for sandblasting.
Gotcha.
And usually I used aluminum oxide to etch instead of sand. So it is a misnomer.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a grit blasting technique. And to this day, because I created the prefabricated stencils to add names to the wall, to this day, I still use a version of that process to prefabricate wildlife art.
Right.
And I do a line of glassware. So I benefited greatly by having to invest time in coming up with another technique.
So out in the lobby before we came in here, you were talking about how this process of picking the songs was very introspective and whatnot. Mm-hmm. What was the process by which you picked these songs?
Wow. I basically went to the artist that impacted me the most. And then the next two songs will be reminiscent of who I was listening to mostly at the time. As I said, I'm a dancer, mm-hmm. and I'm not listening to the lyrics as much as I'm listening to the beat. I like the indigenous beat. You know, I like kind of being able to stomp my heels and do kind of a tribal thing and get kind of into a rhythm. And if I'm listening to the words, that's an improvement. But really, I get caught up in artists that are able to really allow me to move, and then I go there with the music. So it's not the words, sometimes it is, but I noticed that a lot of people are listening to the words and then mouthing the words and they have them in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of being spirited a little bit through movement, a lot through movement. Because when I'm working, you know, in the shop,
right?
I mean, the music is on all the time, and I'm very rhythmic with my work, and the music's almost always on in the background.
All right, well, let's move on to your second song. What do you have here for us?
It is a Otis Redding song, and it's called "Hard to Handle."
And why did it make your three songs list?
Well, it's actually the song that I was listening to mostly when I'd go back and forth to D.C. to add names to the wall. I was really, really open, just getting to know Otis at the time, and he affected me very deeply. So I do recall those songs at that moment.
And that would have been what, on a tape?
That would have been a cassette tape, yeah.
We weren't to CDs yet.
No, this is 1982.
Okay.
So we were definitely into cassettes.
And so you were driving to the where?
From Cleveland to D.C.
Okay.
Back and forth, because I was fabricating stencils and then going to D.C. and holding them up to the wall to see if they were the right font size, because each panel is slightly different. It was a very difficult technique. I mean, no one realized that the variations that you were trying to reproduce from panel to panel, you didn't want an added name to stand out. So, but Otis was there with me the whole way.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is "Hard to Handle" by Otis Redding, which was released in 1968 as a B-side shortly after his death, and then on the 1968 album, The Immortal Otis Redding. You're listening to Three Song Stories.
Baby, here I am, I'm a man on the scene. Give you what you want, but you got to go home with me. I forgot some good old loving, and I got some in store. When I get through throwing it on you, you got to come back for more. Boys and things will come by the dozen, but that ain't nothing but drugstore loving. Pretty little thing, let me light your count, 'cause mama, I'm sure hard to handle now, yes, around. Lighter than word, and I'm a man with a great experience. I know you got you another man, but I can love you better than him. Take my hand, don't be afraid, I wanna prove every word I say. I'm advertising love for free, so won't you raise your ad with me? Boys will call my dime by the dozen, but that ain't nothing but 10 cent love. Pretty little thing, let me light your counter, 'cause mama, I'm sure hard to handle now, yes I am. Baby, here I am, I'm a man on the scene. I can give you what you want, just come go home with me. I got some good old loving, and I got better in store. When I get through throwing it on you, you got to come back for more. Boys will call my dime by my loving, but that ain't nothing but drugstore love. Pretty little thing, let me light the counter, called mama, I'm sure hard to handle now, yes I am.
I could definitely see your predilection for dancing. You were kind of bopping around in the studio. What kind of car were you driving during that
era? Oh, my God.
I want a scene set here. You were in like in a Chevette or something?
Yeah.
Really?
It was a green Pinto.
A Pinto.
A green Pinto. Oh. I think I borrowed my dad's station wagon to go to DC and back. But the green Pinto.
My mom had a brown Pinto. It's one of my early childhood memories. The short-lived Pinto.
Oh, they were all short-lived. I mean, basically, it was three cars a year, and you know, you'd pick it up for $100, and you just try to keep it. Of course, you'd end up putting way more money than if you had invested a little bit more. But it got me around.
You know, I drove up to DC about 6 years ago, just with my dog. I took a random road trip, and I walked around. It was summer. It was very hot, and I couldn't go up to the memorial wall because I had a dog with me. I didn't even think of that. Oh, they have a no-dogs thing. So I kind of got to walk along, but I didn't get to go up close to it. So I've never actually been in the presence of it.
Oh, well, there'll be—
I mean, there's more time for that.
Right.
But I just I was remembering that as we were listening to the song, and I was
thinking about— I hear many, many stories about when they go— – Maya told me that she cut into the earth. So basically it's an underground memorial, and the impact it has on you when you first see it is startling.
Oh, yeah. Even from a dog-safe distance.
Yeah.
What's your best concert experience? Have you seen many shows live?
Oh, wow.
Do you have one that stands out amongst them as the pinnacle of your live music?
There's so many, but one what just popped into my mind when you asked that question. And I got to hear Bob Marley before.
Really?
Yeah, in Cleveland.
I had the episode that came out today. The guest said he was a huge Bob Marley fan, but he never got to see him live. So here we are, full circle.
Yeah, this was probably 78, I think.
What was that like? What was the scene like?
Well, there was a lot of pot being smoked.
Yeah. That's not a cliche.
No. It was filled. The hall was filled. It was public hall in Cleveland, Ohio. And we were kind of up in the balcony, but you knew how special it was.
Mm-hmm.
And although I remember when I first saw The Dead too, I heard how special it was.
I could see you dancing to The Dead.
It didn't quite, it just didn't quite do it for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I wasn't.
Well, I resonate with that too, because it doesn't quite do it for me either.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but everybody claimed it does, and reggae was just more there for me. I don't know, so.
Is there an album that you can think of that you will always listen to every track on, no matter how many times you listen to it? A no-skip album, no-skip track album.
These days I'm hearing a lot of great blues from some Florida artists, and one that speaks loudly to me, say, would be Damon Fowler.
Okay.
Have you heard of him?
I have not.
Well, you have an opportunity because he comes through the Fort Myers area and
play like out in Buckingham.
Buckingham,
yeah.
Blues Bar.
Okay.
Tommy Lee Cook's place. Mm-hmm. And we saw Damon last week, actually.
Oh, really?
And he's right up there for me. And so he's something. And I hope you get a chance to listen.
I'm trying to think. I had a guest on who was talking about a guy he likes from Florida who lives up near Ocala, who comes to the Buckingham Blues Bar. I think he said his name is J.J. Gray.
J.J. Gray. Yeah, Mofro. Now, they're coming for New Year's Eve, I hear.
Are tickets already sold out?
No, I don't think they've even gone on sale. So all you people who are listening to this should just like check that website out every day. So when they do come, we've seen him 4 or 5 times out in the backyard there. And that's quite an event. And J.J.'s just old Florida. I don't think he calls himself a blues artist.
Yeah, no, I think he's just sort of Florida swamp country.
Swamp country, I love it. So JJ actually—
I just made that up. I don't know if
but
it's accurate,
JJ, but. You know, I would listen to, I have to keep coming back to him too. But we have such an opportunity in this Southwest Florida area for the blues. The Southwest Florida Blues Society is very active. And, you know, we even have our own Marty Stokes on the island, who I love. And so there are great opportunities. You might have to venture out a little bit from your little island nest.
Right, right.
But the Prius knows its way.
Right. See, I live in East Fort Myers, so I'm right around the corner.
Well, you have no excuse.
I know. I have no excuse. I need to brush off the hermit in me. How do you listen to music most often these days? Like, do you have like Alexa play me J.J. Gray, or do you have like CDs, or where are you at?
CDs, Spotify are the two go-tos. And so, but they're played through my old receiver and through my Bose speakers.
Okay.
And,
so you're not earbuds
no,
in the
not
studio?
At all.
Okay.
No, I, it just doesn't do it for me. I need to hear the glass in the shop kind of like shake a little
bit.
Yeah,
jingle a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, really. So I test the bass, but I don't want to bother the neighbors too, so I'm trying to be respectful. But I do get carried away. I'm sure you can hear from the street.
When was the last time you bought music that had a physical form?
I bought Damon's new album last
week. Okay, okay. So I've had most of our guests we've asked that have been like, wow, I mean, it's been years.
Because they've
all just gone full streaming, digital, iTunes, all that stuff.
Oh, no. I want to support live artists. And one way you can do that is to go hear them live and then buy their CDs from them. Even though it's going to cost you a little more, they need gas money to make a living. Those folks are amazing. It's in their blood. Support them. Support live music.
We recorded two episodes of this yesterday with the two guys who make our theme song, and they both are live musicians. And one of them said that, you know, he's not really selling CDs anymore because the young kids come up and they're like, what do I do with this shiny thing, old man?
That's their loss. Because, you know, however those artists are trying to help sell their music, please support them. Now, I'm not sure if they're getting, a percentage on Spotify or anything, but...
pennies, I think. I mean,
yeah.
I think if you're getting millions of listens, then you're getting, you know, hundreds of dollars maybe, but yeah.
Well, blues is my thing these days. And, you know, I'm so grateful that the Bonita Springs Blues Festival is around, the Sanibel Blues and Jazz Festival is around. And so there are many ways you could buy a ticket and then support an event. Or just, you know, when that tip jar goes around, stuff it if you can.
Yeah,
you
know?
So,
are there any mainstreamly popular acts out there like that are, you know, right there in the face of culture that you're a big fan of? Or are you more like still listening to the older stuff?
Well, a lot of this contemporary blues is very 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 accessible and being created, you know, every
like
year.
Like your third song, right? I mean, isn't your third song a modern song? Am I correct in that?
Yes, it is.
It was interesting when I Googled it because I didn't recognize it, and you know, and most people are pulling songs up from, you know, from 1968 and 1974, and this is from an album that came out last year, right?
Taj Mahal.
Yeah,
and it is an album that came out last year. We went up to my wife and I went up to Gainesville to listen to them live. And
where are they from? I'm not familiar.
I think California mostly, although Taj is probably from the Delta as well. But we've seen them independently, Taj Mahal and Kev Mo.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, in 2000, we saw Kev Mo at the Monterey Blues Festival, Jazz and Blues Festival, and he was just off to the side. And we knew who he was, but my goodness, we were taken by him. And Taj, we've seen several times over the years, but when the opportunity came to see them together, wow. And so that album CD is potent. That's something that I can listen to. I'll be listening to, you know, a go back to CD album. But these guys have been around a long time. And so they're, but together, co-creating together really was something special.
So what's the story? You know, you drove to Gainesville to see him, but, you know, the other two songs that you chose were from, you know, way back in your life. So why did you choose this as your third song?
Well, I was really going chronologically.
Well, yeah, it is chronologically, but you're going from 1982 to 2017.
Well, I wanted this one, this last one, to represent how we express ourselves through the blues, and that's dancing. And so we're going to a lot of blues festivals. What we do is we'll fly into a city and then bookend the beginning and the end with, say, maybe a festival, a music festival, and then rent our RV and go camping in between. So we live it. This is something that we really we met on the dance floor, and we want to continue dancing. It's what brings us back together all the time. And so there's a lot of new work being produced by young blues artists, and it's not just B.B. King sort of stuff.
It's
the roots are there. But I'm so grateful that there are youngsters picking up the guitars and the rhythms, and not a lot, because when you go out, really, it's just old fogies like me that are really showing up.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's like, you know, 60-year-olds that are attending these events. And I just shake my head. I'm going, oh, my goodness. The youngsters are I think, missing out, because it's just not on the popular scene, as you asked me. You know, what is it that is out there? Now, this is out there, but there are only like maybe 50 people that show up to these events.
Hmm.
So it's all small hall, a lot of small juke joint sort of possibilities to culturally experience this stuff.
Where did you see him in Gainesville?
It was at the University of Gainesville Performing Arts Hall.
Okay.
And we've seen Derek Trucks up there,
mm-hmm,
before he even got together with Susan, and oh my God! I mean, he was totally unlike how he is now. He was footloose and fancy free, and I almost chose him for one of my songs. But we like to listen to Derek's older works. he was allowed to go where he needed to go
right back
then, and so sometimes things happen and your music changes.
Yeah.
So he's there for his wife.
Okay. Well, let's hear your third song and imagine you and your wife in Gainesville listening to it. It's, this is That's Who I Am by Tajmo from their 2017 album, Tajmo. It's Luke Century's third song on this episode of Three Song Stories. You know, for someone who said that they don't really listen to the words that much, mm-hmm. that's a pretty romantic song to be imagining you hanging out with your wife in Gainesville, too.
Oh, yeah. We were hanging out all right, and we were actually the only ones who were dancing. Everyone else was sitting, you know, like they were supposed to. We were in the aisles, got up.
Those people.
Luke and Dee were just letting it go. There was no way we were going to sit through this concert, and so no one told us to sit down. We tried to be not in anyone's way. But, you know, the lyric, part of the lyric, looking for myself when I found you.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the one I first latched onto. I was at the crow's nest with you when I heard that. Oh. You know what I mean? Like, I just felt like, that's the full circle.
It was a circle dance at the crow's nest quite a bit when we were listening to the Modulators from Cincinnati. They everyone fell in love there, you know, during the 80s. So we actually had on Captiva a lot of good music coming through.
You mentioned Captiva. You're an experimental artist, mm-hmm. Robert Rauschenberg. Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever cross paths?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, I knew a lot of folks who worked for him. I knew Robert himself. Actually, you know, I probably could have gone there and worked as one of the tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just needed to do my own thing.
Yeah.
And
did you ever party out there? I know you had some pretty good boathouse
parties.
Yeah,
there was some partying going on there. Really not my cup of tea, though.
Right. That wasn't your scene?
No, it wasn't. The Voitex invited us out, and they, you know, Dee and I went, and it just never really totally gelled. Just wasn't our scene. So we gave it a whirl, and we were welcome, but it was it just wasn't for us. But you know, he's an amazing artist, and love his work, love a lot of his work. But I think I collaborated here and there a little bit with, you know, some of the workers who were doing work for him.
Right.
So you know, I was a little bit a part of it.
I got the opportunity to go out there to the residency about mm-hmm. 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Their normal photographer that they would have come in to take pictures of all the different residents in mm-hmm. their little places had fallen through, and so I was recommended. So I got to spend 10 hours out there with a camera.
Okay.
And I enjoyed taking pictures of all the artists. That was great. But I really enjoyed being in his fabrication house.
Amazing.
I just took pictures of – because there's still the stuff there where he left it. And you know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's like the to-do lists on the wall and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I just walked around and took pictures of that stuff.
It's amazing. And the fish house out there
too. Yeah. I got to stand on the roof of the fish house. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I felt like I was brushing right up against history. You know?
Great history. And he did so much for Captiva by purchasing land and preventing development. From extending unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. And he was a great supporter of the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. And he has priorities straight as far as the islands go.
We're pretty much out of time. Do you have any final thoughts for this process? You want to try to wrap it up somehow?
Well, it was a growth process for me, you know, to be able to try to tie one's life together through music. It's, you know, in a structured way. I need structure.
Right.
So I'm so grateful for being your guest, and I hope that people come out of the woodwork and scream, I want to be on your show.
Well, we are having some screams. We are having some screams. And what's interesting for me and for Richard, and I think for listeners too, is that, you know, this process becomes part of our memory. And so I'm hearing now songs that were guests' songs that have more meaning to me because of the story they told me. And I think that's just sort of how music works. It just keeps going out. And in some ways, I think it ties into your whole artistic process somehow.
Being open and being brave, you know, just going where no man's gone before.
Yeah. All right. Luke Century, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks so much.
We record and produce this show in the WGCU studios on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is our show's co-creator and producer. Our online content producer is Tara Callaghan. Our executive producer is Chris Duffus. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Here's your friendly reminder to send us your song stories. I know you've got one. Just find a song that will always bring you back to a time and place and story and write it out and email it to mysongstory@wgcu.org. We'll get in touch and help you record your story and use it as a parting tune at some point down the three song stories road. For my parting tune this week, I'm going back to a trailer in my dad's front yard in Kansas City the summer of 2001. I was staying there for a few weeks at the end of a multi-month road trip. I was actually considering making a big change and not going back to Fort Myers at all, except to get my stuff and come back north. You see, the relationship I was in was ending against my wishes, and this was all happening at a distance, and it was all happening in the sweltering summer heat. And through it all, I was listening to the newest album from my favorite band, Moxie Fruvis, that had come out that previous fall. This song was the one that was ringing the truest. It's called Independence Day, and it's the song that I wound up sharing with the good friend who I was corresponding with back home and who wound up being the main force that made me decide to come home and who wound up later becoming my partner and my daughter's mother and still one of my best friends today, despite the fact that we went our separate ways on the 4th of July about 8 years later. This is Independence Day by Moxie Fruvis from their 1999 album Thornhill. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
This is Independence Day. next time on Three Song Stories.
Like a frog singing You Are My Sunshine on The Muppet Show.
Oh.
I think
a
like,
frog or the frog?
I don't know if it was Kermit or not, because like they had like, you know, they had your side frogs, you know what I mean? They had, you know, we can't all be Kermits, all right? It's